It's Friday, May 29th, 2020. I'm Stephen Fee, and this is The Pen Pod, a limited-run podcast from Pen America. On today's edition, the dragons, the giant, the women, we talk to author Wea Tu Moore about her latest book, a memoir blending family storytelling and magic with the heartache of war. Then we put our tough questions to Pen America CEO Suzanne Nossel. This week, the president goes on the attack against Twitter. Suzanne walks us through an executive order signed Thursday. I'm Stephen Fee. All that coming up on the Pen Pod. Wea Tu Moore is a Liberian-American author whose debut novel, She Would Be King, explored Liberia's founding through a group of three supernaturally gifted characters. Her next text, a memoir, is called The Dragons, The Giant, The Women, and publishes next month. Wea Tu Moore joins me now. Hi, Wea Tu.
Hi, how are you?
I'm well. So, you know, I am looking forward so much to your upcoming book. And my understanding is it really dives into your experience growing up amid wartime Liberia. Tell me what brought you to write this book.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much. It's definitely been a long road. I think in many ways I've been writing some version of this book since I was old enough to write. Mostly through incoherent poetry, but it didn't take form until I returned to Liberia. It was only after I returned to Liberia after being away for about 25 years that it made sense to put my experience on paper. And honestly, once I did, I actually hesitated sharing it because I had this moment in the beginning of my career around the time that my novel came out when I was still determining my literary identity and I was afraid of being pigeonholed and for my work to be seen through the lens of my personal life or former tragedies and traumas. But I realized that that's unproductive thinking. Like, people were going to associate me with my culture and my past anyway. I think that for certain writers, especially immigrant writers and POC writers, there's an inherent interest in backstories. And sometimes that's used to market the book. Sometimes it does have more of a dubious nature. And I think additionally, the interest in one's personal life does have to do with the reader's need to contextualize the story and understand thematic arcs or other ambiguities that may be present in the work. So I had to sort of just get out of that train of thinking and figured if it was going to be done anyway, then I want to make sure that the story is the most true story that can be told. I left Liberia when I was 5 and spent my childhood and adolescent years in the southern United States, in Texas. And that results in a consciousness that I needed to explore, right? So also, I was raised reading things about Liberia that were almost always written by non-Liberians. And right. I didn't discover Liberian writers until I was in college. So representation is important, not just what's on the page, but who's holding the pen. And I do want to contribute to literature about Liberia and be intentional about her truths and complexities in my work. So this is just another way to do that.
Yeah. I mean, you were kind enough a couple of years ago to take part in an interview on our website that we do called the Pen 10. And we asked you about the relationship between your work and truth, and you said that you intentionally disengage with my understanding of history when I write. And I wonder how that ethos informed your process of writing something that was more in the memoir genre.
Yeah, you know what? Like, my memoir is actually the opposite of that. Like, for my first draft, I didn't speak to anyone in my family about what I was writing because I didn't want it to affect my understanding and recollection of what had happened and how it happened, right? So of course, some of that history relied on what I'd been previously told or things I'd heard family members say over the years, but that first draft was sacred to me. So I looked at old pictures, listened to music, and really meditated quite a bit to really reawaken my understanding of my childhood. And so I would say it's the inverse experience for me. I wanted to fully engage with that understanding of history, my personal history, my country's history, in that first draft. And then, of course, as I edited, I was seeking the stories and the perspectives, especially my mother's, of things that were happening outside of me, external to me and external to my understanding.
Yeah. I want to ask you a bit more about the bit about, you know, writing about family. And you said you didn't want to, it was sacred to you in the beginning. I mean, was there a point in your process where you showed drafts to family members? Did you bring them into the process with you, or did you need to sort of keep them a little bit separate from it?
I think at the maybe like second or third draft, when there were historical references that, I knew it would be important to my family to get right. So I was absolutely talking to, not showing them drafts. I didn't show them a draft until like toward the end, until actually it was accepted, but having conversations, like, hey, you know, mom, I wrote this scene, or I wrote about an instance where this happened and this is how I remember it. Is that how you remembered it? What do you think about this? And so that's how I got their input on the work, was really through conversations and listening to those oral histories. But no, they didn't read it until much later on.
Yeah. Well, I want to ask, so, I mean, in She Would Be King, you know, you had this sort of, you know, and I know it's a lazy interviewer's crutch, but, you know, this device of magical realism, this idea of things that are a little bit outside of reality. And I understand that with the memoir, you were able to maybe also play with that a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, my dad, I just love him so much. He was working overtime to make sure that we were physically safe, but he, in many ways, was trying to preserve our childhood and keep us mentally and psychologically safe during just a really traumatic time. What could have really disrupted our childhoods and our faith in humanity and affected us long term, didn't, because he continued to, throughout that experience, play these games with us that made what was happening, I wouldn't say minimize it, but always gave us something to look forward to. Like, he inserted and incorporated like a sense of hopefulness in our everyday. So we'd say, oh, we're going to go see mom now, but we have to fly over that river. So, you know, pretending that we were flying when we were on canoes, and, you know, making peace with some of the more traumatic things. Like when we saw people, dead on the road, my understanding was that they were just sleeping. So he would, every time we walked down a road that there were cadavers, he would say, oh, well, gosh, people are sleeping again. So it wasn't until much later on that I fully grasped the extent and how profound what was going on really was. And that's because of my father. So I would say now I think I could look back at it and say that there was a bit of a fantastical element to that experience. But when I was in it, it was just real life. I fully believe that people were on the road sleeping. I fully believe that we were, you know, we were going to fly through a river. And that's because of my father. And I think, like, also there was definitely a cognitive dissonance, because as I was living in that belief, I think the doubt and the danger and some of the fear was inching its way in. And so by the time we did reach America, when the nightmares began and I did have a period of adjustment, it had fully, what I had understood as being a game and being fantastical was almost suddenly eclipsed. And I don't know whether or not it was because of the drama of being in a new space and really trying to understand my surroundings and the implications of our move. But yeah, I think it was sustained. My innocence was sustained much longer than it would have been. And that's because of my dad.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I want to turn briefly to, I know, in addition to your work as a writer, because everyone's got a side gig, that you've also founded one more book, a publishing house to bring books, especially about underrepresented people to kids. And I'm wondering what that experience has been like for you.
Yeah, I mean, publishing and publishing specifically for children who aren't always used to seeing their names and languages in books, it's just been my reason for the past decade. I'm most proud of what the organization has done. with such a small team and limited resources. But unfortunately, after 10 years this year, I'm taking a step back from the publishing arm of the nonprofit to focus on our Liberia-based projects like the bookstore and literary events. Because I believe that there's really just no greater empowerment that you could give a child than literacy. And it's always been so powerful and beautiful for that relationship with the written word to include their individual cultural truths. But it's also important to give just fierce attention to different elements of that that literary road or journey and different elements of what literacy means. And I think for me, balancing publishing and the bookstore and so many other things under the One More Book arm, it's become more and more important to me to do the organization and do our mission justice. And so we have published 26 books so far for from four different countries. And now I think 2.0 and this next decade will be more singularly focused on the Liberia projects, because I think that's truly where we can be the most useful. And I don't want to be broad for the sake of being broad, but I do want to be precise in our intentions, because I think that's the way that we can be most valuable and most efficient.
Yeah. I love thinking about the second decade. That's great. Yeah. And you know, I know there's so much happening in the world right now. I mean, we're all sort of in this weird limbo, and this crisis is impacting everyone differently. But just to wrap up, I'm wondering what you think the role of writers is right now.
Yeah, I really loved this question. I loved this question this morning. I think for me, it's like to be still, actually, to observe. Like I started writing something before COVID and have totally taken a break from it to be a part of what is happening, to see it, to hear it, and to feel it fully. And of course, that can't last for too long because of deadlines.
Right.
But I especially, at the beginning of this, I appreciated the opportunity, or rather, I appreciate being forced to sit still, because I'm one of those hyper-productive people. And unfortunately, it's the only way I could get anything done. So how profound to be a witness, and to be a witness with my hands tied behind my back, where I'm not like going, but I can really just sit still. And I usually hesitate speaking for all writers, but for me, I believe my responsibility is just to watch this and to feel this first, allow myself to really feel what's happening and let it move through me. Then I can act through my work. Then I can negotiate the relationship it has with my writing and my craft. But right now I'm just trying to, in many ways I can, of course, before the deadlines start to loom, to practice being still.
Yeah. And anything that you're reading right now that you think would be interesting for folks listening in?
Yes. Yeah. I've been reading a lot of nonfiction during this time. Currently I'm reading Bell Hooks, the Sisters of the Yam, like Black Women in Self-Recovery, Sisters of the Yam. And then it's really just about how like our emotional health is impacted by the different sociopolitical structures. And then also Steve Biko's I Write What I Like.
Mm-hmm.
And he is obviously he was one of the leaders during the apartheid movement. And it's so quotable. My favorite quote from the book is the most potent weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, thank you. Weya Tumor is author of She Would Be King. Her book, The Dragons, The Giant, The Women, comes out next month. Thank you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Late Thursday, President Trump signed an executive order aimed at limiting the legal protections afforded social media companies. From the Oval Office, he said, "We're here today to defend free speech from one of the gravest dangers it has faced in American history, frankly." To walk us through this order, what it means, and its implications for free speech, I'm joined now by our CEO, Suzanne Nossel, for a special installment of our weekly Tough Questions series. Hi, Suzanne.
Hi, Stephen.
All right, so help me understand what's going on here. It seems like some of this is rooted in this grievance by the president that Twitter and other platforms are censoring conservative speech, but also in an incident that popped up earlier this week. How did we get here?
Yeah, sure. So the president has long accused the social media platforms of targeting conservative speech and favoring progressive speech. And look, these companies are headquartered in Silicon Valley. I think it's true that most of their executives kind of skew liberal, and there are a lot of people on the platforms who may disagree with the president on all kinds of issues, but there has never been any real proof adduced of this bias in the platform. There's some small studies that have been done, but they kind of point in different directions. There's no conclusive evidence of that, but there is a suspicion and a belief that these companies are out to get conservative users, that are quick to shut them down, to delete their posts, and that their speech is policed in a way that isn't done on the other side of the political spectrum. So that's been a longstanding thing. The White House opened up its own kind of channel for people to submit complaints of social media bias to them. And they were looking at measures that they might take to try to address that. But it seemed to be sort of a back burner issue. And then what we saw this week was a first, which was the president tweeted about issues that he claimed arose in relation to balloting by mail. There's, of course, great concern about the election coming up and how and whether it's going to be safe for people to go to the polls. So many states are taking steps to expand the availability of balloting by mail, sending out applications for absentee ballots and making that much more accessible. And the president tweeted saying this raises all sorts of issues and there's a greater probability of fraud in relation to ballot by mail. And Twitter, for the first time, marked those tweets by the president and put a link saying, if you want more information about it, you might look here. And in those pieces that it linked to, including a report from CNN, essentially they said that the president's claims were untrue and that the issues that he claimed were associated with balloting by mail are false. So the president went ballistic at the notion that he was being fact-checked by a social media company and said his free speech rights were being infringed upon. And it was a real outburst earlier this week. And then we got wind on Wednesday night that a executive order was in the works and that the White House would be issuing something. And it was pretty clear, early drafts of this started to leak. It was pretty clear they had taken some pieces that had been written up in relation to this issue of political bias, and that they got kind of supercharged by the president's ire over being fact-checked by Twitter, and now he was ready to sort of pounce with something that probably had been in the works but on the back burner for some time. And then last night on Thursday evening, they issued this executive order. It really reads like something that was pulled up from someone's computer file and then infused with some ritual anger from the president, sort of almost what you might imagine him saying from behind the White House podium when he's angry about something. And he did make a kind of rather bitter sounding set of remarks to introduce this social media order, saying he would have shut down Twitter if he could find a way to legally do so. That's what he would have done. And instead, we have this quite lengthy and complicated and I think in several respects kind of extra legal executive order that exceeds the bounds of executive authority and travels over the provenance of the Congress and tries to rewrite the law. It sort of does a lot of things. Exactly how it will be applied remains to be seen. But what's crystal clear here is this is an act of vindictiveness. I mean, he was angry at Twitter for what they did earlier this week, and he took that out on not just them, but all social media platforms, all websites in the form of this executive order that I think can only be seen as punitive. And for us at Pen America, of course, you know, as you know, we sued the president almost 2 years ago for his threats and acts of retaliation against journalists and the media based on reporting or questions that he disliked. And this is, you know, really precisely part of that pattern, going after those that say things he dislikes and using the power of the federal government to exact reprisals, which is in violation of the First Amendment and an abuse of power. So there's a lot in there in terms of this executive order and what it might do and what it represents.
Yeah, I mean, we don't have to go through every element of it, but I'm wondering if you can help us distill sort of what's in it and what it tries to do and whether or not you think it passes the smell test.
You know, I'll say one thing to begin with. I mean, some of the issues that the executive order raises are legitimate. You know, there are concerns about the role that the social media platforms play in policing content and the discretion that they have and the degree to which political or profit-making or other sorts of considerations are brought to bear. And the social media companies, as the executive order points out, are positioned to control great swaths of, you know, what we used to call our public square. So much of our discourse in societies happens on, whether it's on Facebook or on Twitter, on Google. And so the decisions they make about what the parameters of permissible content are, what you aren't allowed to say, what posts are going to be deleted, what's going to be algorithmically suppressed, you know, those decisions end up having a great deal of influence over our discourse. So to the extent it's raising those concerns, they are legitimate. But the question is, what do you do about them? And, you know, my concern is really by placing government in this position where he's asking federal agencies to intrude in this area and to make rules and to force the companies to police content at penalty of liability, that to me is even more concerning. The idea that, you know, rather than having social media serve as our content police, we're going to have the government do it. It's prohibited by the First Amendment, and I think for very good reason. Probably the most controversial and consequential aspect of the executive order relates to Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is a essentially a provision that immunizes the social media platforms from liability for content that is posted on the platforms. And so if you post content that's unlawful on Twitter or on Facebook, the company cannot be held liable. For example, you know, if it's a threat or if it's harassment or in some other way unlawful content. And there are a few kind of carve-outs and exceptions, including for child pornography, but it's a very broad grant of immunity from liability. And people give that provision credit for sort of the internet as we know it. And a lot of people believe that the kind of free-for-all, freewheeling, expansive, sweeping internet as we know it would disappear if liability for content posted on those platforms were made possible. And what the president essentially called for is to look into how the platforms can be held accountable for certain kinds of, you know, what he's calling editorial decisions. So it would be things like the decision to post the fact check in relation to his tweet. He wants to explore whether and how companies can be held liable for something like that.
Yeah. I mean, and of course, as you mentioned, I mean, this Section 230, you know, obviously was passed in 96. You know, as you bring up, I mean, the president is right, perhaps, to bring up some of these principles. But I mean, he can't just override Congress, can he?
No, I mean, Section 230 is law. This executive order cannot rewrite our law. If that provision is going to be amended, it needs to be taken up by the Congress. You know, there are reasonable minds that think Section 230 should be pared back in some way, and that the grant of liability is too sweeping and blanket, and that there needs to be, you know, for example, a proviso that would require the companies to act in good faith. There is a good faith provision that applies to a portion of Section 230. Someone would like to see it expanded. So I think that is a valid debate, but this is not the way to go about it. You don't issue a hastily worded executive order that attempts to override the prerogatives of Congress.
Right. Just finally, so you put out a statement late yesterday and you said this was an instance of the president reaping what he has sown. What did you mean?
Well, look, the president has made great use of Twitter to build his following and expound his ideology. In some cases, I think, to mislead and deceive and cast aspersions. And, you know, now he's upset that the same thing is happening in his direction. And that's something that the platform has done, cast him in a negative light. So, you know, I think it's part of what you bargain for when you go out on these platforms, that it is very freewheeling. You know, Twitter has free speech rights as well, and the president can't override those.
Yeah. Well, Suzanne, let's leave it there. Suzanne Nossel, CEO of PEN America and author of the forthcoming book, Dare to Speak, Defending Free Speech for All. Thanks a lot, Suzanne.
Thank you.
And that's our episode for Friday, May 29th, 2020. Join us next week for the PEN Pod. You can listen to all our episodes at PEN.org. Follow us at PEN America on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. You can sign up on our website for our daily DARE newsletter. That's where we track major stories about literature, free expression, and the news of the world. I'm Stephen Fee for PEN America. Talk to you Monday.